Thank you for choosing to listen to Phoenix Fire today. Phoenix Fire features John Anthony West. You can access the Phoenix Fire blog at www.jawphoenixfire.blogspot.com. You can learn more about John Anthony West by going to www.jawest.net.
Phoenix Fire number 4.
This is Phoenix Fire. John Anthony West, rogue Egyptologist and mystic in skeptics clothing, broadcasting from West Henge in the wilderness with something to offend everyone. Welcome to the conflagration. No major surprises in store, said Peter LaCovara, curator of Egyptology at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, Part 2. So, we concluded our last program with all hell breaking loose at the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America in San Diego in 1991. The press was there, the television cameras were rolling, we were on radio. Everything was happening, and of course the comments, the fury started coming back in from the Egyptologists and the archaeologists. That one, no major surprises in store, is one of my all-time favorites, and it makes me think sometimes that humanity will never learn. It's that one's to be added to a great long list of them I have somewhere on the computer about those kinds of bloopers, no major surprises in store. It's perhaps not quite the equal to the greatest one of all time, which was recorded in 1897 by Charles Duell, who was the Commissioner of Patents for the United States Patent Office. And Duell said in 1897, everything that can be invented has been invented. So that's the all-time favorite on the list of wonderful sayings, but there are many, many more. There's the President of Cunard back in 1927, following Lindbergh's flight across the Atlantic, that, oh, well, this is a wonderful stunt and a step forward for mankind, but, of course, the airplane will never be suitable for any sort of commercial venture. And the head of the carriage industry in America, just prior to the invention of the Model T, Ford, said, well, yes, this is a rich man's toy, but the horse and carriage is here to stay, etc., etc. I like to think that Mr. LaCovara's no surprises in store line will be added to that illustrious list somewhere along the line. In any event, back to our press conferences and our show and our GSA meeting. So the archaeologists and the Egyptologists came at us and the press were calling us up. In general, considering the radical nature of what we were putting forward, we were handled relatively gently, actually, in part because what was at stake here was not a revolution within Egyptology. Rather, it was a conflict between Egyptology and geology, two almost separate disciplines. So in any event, mostly the press was remarkably fair about this. And one of the favorite stories, mine anyway, comes from, again, from Boston. The science editor of the Boston Globe interviewed Schock and myself right while we were at the conference on the telephone. And when he was interviewing me, he was talking about the geologists at the show, all very impressed by our evidence, and the Egyptologists and the archaeologists up in absolutely in an uproar. And he said to me, he said, well, why do you think they are in such an uproar? And rather than answer the question directly, I simply said that, look, doesn't matter if they're in an uproar. This evidence is based upon the weathering patterns in rocks, and it comes to an opinion on weathering patterns in rocks. An Egyptologist's opinion is no better than a proctologist's, and they printed that. This had some interesting repercussions, actually, because Schock teaches at Boston University, and they apparently, when he got back home after a couple of days, they were in an absolute uproar, particularly over the proctologist line, and there was an Egyptologist there, woman, and I'll just not use her name here, but she's still there, and she wrote an absolutely scandalous article. It was a personal attack and a character assassination of Schock, not me, it was Schock, in the Boston BU, Boston University in-house journal or paper, whatever it is. And it was really, I mean, this was very nasty and very unprofessional. And so Schock didn't want to respond to it. Schock knows how to play this game, and he's not combative as such. He's not like me. He knows how to fight back, but not that way, not publicly. He didn't want to go tit for tat. So I decided, and I ran this by him first, if he minded if I wrote her a personal letter back, not for publication. And so he gave me the go-ahead, and I wrote her a letter and said that, I understand that I read her article in the Boston University paper about Schock, which I considered both underhanded and unprofessional, and that I understood that their department was upset by both our theory and certain of the things that we said about the academic establishment, and that especially what they objected to was my own line, my quote about the proctologist line, that an Egyptologist's geological opinion is no better than a proctologist. And I wrote her and I said, well, look, I said, I can appreciate that, but you've got to know that the proctologist didn't like it either. They complained. They said that their job was to cure sick assholes. They didn't like being compared to them. So this, needless to say, did not smooth the waters over there at Boston University Archaeological Department. And I understand that the lady in question circulated my letter out into the world of quackademic Egyptology to everybody important that she could think of, which was, as a matter of fact, the thing I could most have wished for in all the world, because I never would have sent it off myself. I wouldn't even have had a mailing list of who to send to. So she did the work for me, and I understand that this is 15 years later now, that I'm still not often invited to the archaeological department of Boston University to give valedictory addresses or anything of the sort. I don't know why. But anyway, it was this sort of thing that was going on. I mean, the controversy was raging in those early years, and actually it hasn't even died down now. It's 15 years later, we'll be getting to that over the course of this next, if not this talk, then the next one, because Mystery of the Sphinx, or Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, seems to be acquiring steam as we go along, so it may take longer than I'd initially anticipated to get the whole story in, even in long-winded as this is. It's still cutting an awful lot of interesting material out. So all of the press is coming in, and we're battling back. A tremendous amount of our time is spent now answering the objections that are coming in. Most of the objections, actually, are repetitions of each other. Almost none of them have any real academic weight. In other words, it's not the geologists who are talking. This is Egyptologists and archaeologists who are saying, well, it doesn't fit into their context. Well, yes, we agree. It doesn't fit into your context. Change your context, because here's our evidence, and it's geology. Later on, we will be getting, and we'll get to this, we will be getting a few geologists trying to attack the theory, but they are, almost without exception, geologists with a stake in Egyptology. And it doesn't matter, actually, if they have a stake in Egyptology, if they don't have a stake in Egyptology. Nothing matters except the quality of their evidence, and the evidence ranges from just plain wrong to actually ludicrous and idiotic. And we'll be getting into some of that, but a lot of it is technical, and most of it depends upon visual, so it's hard to describe or talk about these things. It's even hard with pictures. It's best discussed on the site, and this is what we hope to do when we get our geo panel in place. More upon that as we go along as well. In any event, now here, at this point, the story starts becoming increasingly complex with a number of other unanticipated aspects coming to play a role in it. Some of them very important to our theory, others not necessarily important, but important to the, let's say, the ongoing sequence of the story. Because, okay, we've had our big show, we've had headlines all over the world, but now what do we do to keep it going? Because on this particular battlefield, and if anyone thinks that an academic dispute is not a battlefield, you've never been in an academic arena fighting this kind of particular, you've got to keep fighting the battle, or in fact, you will get buried, you'll be obscured into the background, you'll be painted into corners, and doors will be shut in your face. And if you can't keep the noise level going, the PR level going, you're going to be toast in short order. This is actually a standard academic ploy of silencing the opposition, is to simply quibble it into non-existence. So the whole world, the intelligent, the reading audience or the listening audience, simply wearies of the controversy, and they win because it's their battlefield. So this had to be avoided at all costs, if possible. And then a number of things come into play from unanticipated directions. One of the most interesting was the nature of the Sphinx itself, the head on the Sphinx. Now, if you have a mental picture of the Sphinx, and practically everybody does, you'll know that it's fairly ruinous, or I should say damaged, human head on a lion's body. And we've already discussed the body of the core body, the bedrock body of the Sphinx is deeply weathered, as everyone knows, with lots of repair blocks applied to it. The face itself has the nose destroyed and there's damage around the eyes, but otherwise it's in pretty good state of preservation because it is a much harder outcrop of limestone than the rest of the body. It's called member three. Member one, which is a harder limestone, member two, that's the core body. And then there's the head itself, and it's the only instance of this harder limestone on the plateau. And probably originally it was jutting up above the ground, and that's a much harder limestone altogether. And that's what the head is carved from. Now, we have to backtrack still further now, about another 8 or 9 years, without going into the long history of the Egyptology and archaeology that solidified into the dogma that it is Khafra, the follower of Khufu, supposed builder of the Great Pyramid, Khafra, his son, builder of the Second Pyramid, and that he carved the Sphinx, and that the Sphinx is carved in his image. Now, this is similarity like beauty is to a certain extent in the eye of the beholder. Back in the 80s, Mark Lehner, who is, let's say, the loyal or the disloyal opposition, one of our chief opponents throughout this entire controversy, did an early study on with the state-of-the-art computer graphics of the time. We're talking about middle 80s or so. This would not be, you know, your three-year-old could today use more complex computer graphics than were available to anybody back in those days. And this was an attempt by Lehner to verify or disqualify the idea that Egyptologists had that the Great Sphinx, the face of the Great Sphinx, was meant to represent the face of Khafra. Now, actually, there are lots of faces of Khafra, or anyway, a few very famous ones. The most famous probably in the Cairo Museum, the wonderful statue that's there with the king with the falcon comprising the whole back of his head, these acquired falcon or Horus consciousness, wonderful masterpiece of sculpture. And then there's the Sphinx, which, in fact, anybody can see doesn't look the least bit like Khafra, anybody but Egyptologists. Anyway, Lehner did a study, and I'm doing it a bit of a disservice here. It's actually more complicated than this. But he effectively, what he did was to feed Khafra data into the computer using computer models in some way or shape that I don't quite understand. And then out the computer spews out Kafka data, and Lehner superimposes that data upon, or that printout, whatever it was, the printout upon the head of the, upon the lion's body, and says, voila, there's Kafka. It's Kafka after all. This had a lot of press. It was Smithsonian, I think Smithsonian Magazine, New York Times, all over the place. And accepted by Lehner's academic colleagues without any question, even though it's self-evident to anybody who goes to Egypt and looks at the Sphinx and then looks at the statue of Khafre, or any statue of Khafre in any of the museums where there are Khafre statues, that these are not the same individuals. No way. Anyhow, normally this would not be the kind of thing that you'd have to bother to address. As I said earlier, similarity like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and there's no scientific argument about this. However, since Lehner had had all of this press for his computer simulation, it was now important because it had now gone down into the literature. Oh, well, Lehner has proved that the Sphinx really is Khafre after all. End of argument. The hell with the geology. So we were obliged to address this, or somebody was going to be obliged to address this. Now, the weird thing is that all along I had felt that the only way to do this was to get an artist or a photographer or somebody to do some sort of a study that compared the two faces, and or a model of some way or another in which you got people who really knew what they were talking about, who were artists by trade or photographers, to do a comparative study of these two faces, because they don't look any the least bit alike. Anyway, now that we were in the process of doing or putting together our video, we knew that we were going to have to do a video, because if we were going to keep this controversy alive, we had to get it onto the airwaves somehow or another. And so I mentioned this idea to my now partner, Boris, about getting an artist or a photographer in to do some sort of a comparative study. And Boris is immediately thought of one of his brilliant ideas. Boris was not normally the idea man, but he suggested bringing in one of the forensic detectives who was a real expert in faces, somebody who made a living out of comparing faces and doing forensic photographs or doing forensic reconstructions from people's memories and that sort of thing. So within 15 minutes, he was on the line with Frank Domingo, the senior forensic detective from New York City's police department. And all of a sudden, we had an idea going. Actually, initially, we weren't even thinking of bringing in an artist. The original idea, my original idea, even before any of this was going on, was that to use Lehner's exact same method and of computer reconstruction, but using Elvis as the model and proving by using the exact same method that it was really Elvis who was the Sphinx and not Khafre. Unfortunately, the Elvis Foundation at the time would not let us use the king in that particular, that kind of a format or that particular kind of a representation, which I thought was really very short-sighted of them, because I would think that Elvis would have loved to have had his head up on the Sphinx. But anyway, they wouldn't do it, and so we had to settle for Frank Domingo, senior forensic expert for NYPD.
Phoenix Fire!
So Boris had made this contact. I never would have thought of it. It probably took him, and if I had thought of it, it would have taken me a month to get around to do it. Boris was on the phone with Frank Domingo within 15 minutes, getting through whatever protocol you had to go through, explaining to Domingo on the phone what it was that he was after, what we were after. Domingo, of course, has never heard of a forensic detective being brought in to verify or disqualify an Egyptological conflict, but he was sufficiently intrigued to want to talk to me on the telephone. And we will introduce you to Frank Domingo in a couple of minutes following our adverts. Thank you.
Phoenix Fire!
Surprise! Until we find sponsors for our dedicated ad space, it's still John Anthony West, here to tell you about my personally guided Magical Egypt Tours. There's a fascination about Egypt, a glamour, a romance. On my trips, people tell me they've been dreaming of traveling to Egypt since early childhood. There are other wonderful sacred places in the world, Gothic cathedrals, Mayan pyramids, Islamic mosques, Hindu and Buddhist temples. But there is nothing anywhere that matches the grandeur, power, and perfection of Egypt. Yet unless you see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you've not seen Egypt at all. For it is only the symbolist interpretation developed by the brilliant philosopher, mathematician, and alchemist R.A. Shvala de Lubitsch that makes sense of the Egyptian experience. Where establishment academics see only a bizarre, architecturally accomplished but still primitive civilization, Shvala saw and proved that it was based upon a profound and sophisticated sacred science, a science of cosmic principles. One wonders how people come back from Egypt and live lives the way they lived them before, wrote Florence Nightingale back in 1850. The answer is, they don't. 2 weeks in Egypt and you will understand the difference, finally, between true civilization and progress. For detailed information, see my website, jawest.net. Click on Magical Egypt Tours. These are one-of-a-kind trips. There is nothing like them. We find ways to avoid crowds. We meditate in the Great Pyramid. We get into places other people don't get into. The food is great. So are the hotels. The price is remarkably competitive. Just remember, if you don't see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you don't see Egypt at all.
Phoenix Fire!
Welcome back. We left our hero, who is me, with a new name to conjure with, Frank Domingo, senior forensic detective with the New York City Police Department, the famed NYPD. So I got Domingo on the phone and I explained to him now in my sort of scholarly way what Boris had put to him in a rather less scholarly way about the nature of the controversy. And Domingo was interested enough to decide to meet me, not in his office, but down in lower New York at a bar next to where all the cops went on their off time. Big building, and we have that in the video, actually, ultimately, in the Mystery of the Sphinx. And so for me, this was something new. I have to admit that I have a number of prejudices, and cops are one of them. I'm not the least ambivalent about my attitude toward most cops. In fact, there's a Welsh saying, when I lived in Wales for a number of years, one of the Welsh sayings that I liked was, never trust a bull or a cop. So there I was meeting with an appointment set up to meet Frank Domingo in front of whatever that big building is in New York. And so I went down there, and we had figured out a way to identify each other. And I met up with Frank, medium-sized guy, nattily dressed in a light tan suit. It's the summer now. Very cordial. And we go into, I've got a copy of Serpent in the Sky with me, and we go into, takes me around the corner where is this bar with all sorts of cops in various stages of uniform and disuniform drinking some beers. And he starts talking to me about the theory, and he's asking me questions. And I'm explaining it to him. He's being very polite. And I realize at a certain point, I'm getting grilled. I've never been grilled before. And everything that I say is potentially going to be used against me. So I suddenly realize I've got to be really careful about what's going on here. And so finally we get down to basically to the nitty-gritty, and Frank understands that what we want to do is to, via standard forensic procedures, to determine whether or not the face on the Sphinx is meant to be or can be proved to be or can be proved not to be the face of the Pharaoh Khafre, as we know the Pharaoh Khafre from the various statues of him, but particularly the one in the Cairo Museum, which is also the most accessible. He understands that, and now exactly what it is that's involved, and says to me, well, he said, suppose I do this work and it turns out to be the face of Khafre. What would you do then? And I say, well, I publish it, naturally. That's what we want you along for. He said, okay, count me in. All along, by the way, I should say, we're doing all of this work, all of the science, but with at least a good portion of our attention focused on how we're going to do a video of all of this. So really, we're going about the documentary in a sort of bizarre way, because normally when you're doing a documentary film, you know exactly what you want to do and exactly where you're going to take it. You have a plan in mind, and you go after it. I mean, for example, Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, he knows where he wants to get to. The facts are all there. How he gets there, there are different ways of doing it. He gets interviews, he doesn't get interviews, he edits, so forth and so on. But he knows where he's heading. In this case, we don't know where we're heading because we're inventing the theory, even. But we're inventing the science as we go along, and we have a long way to go before we've got enough in place so that we can make the show out of it that we know we need in order to keep the whole controversy alive.
Phoenix Fire!
Well, anyway, Frank is playing a substantial role in this, even though, strictly speaking, from a scientific point of view, his evidence will be neither here nor there from an archaeological or Egyptological or even art historical point of view. His opinion will be very important, because if he says it is the face of Khafre, even that makes our argument more difficult, but it doesn't actually disqualify it, because we're convinced from the get-go that Khafre does in fact play a major role with the Sphinx. There's a causeway that leads from the Sphinx to his pyramid. His pyramid is not built entirely by him, but has earlier, we get somewhere along the line, we'll get to a pyramid show and talk about the multi-stage construction of the pyramids. But there is a connection, and we believe that Khafre is actually the first of the Egyptian pharaohs to do repairs upon the Sphinx. We're quite happy with that. So even if the face turned out to be Khafre, we have a kind of an escape route, in that Khafre has the Sphinx, whatever the ruined face of the Sphinx might have been, carved into an image of himself. But that's a tougher point to prove. It's a little bit like saying, well, Will Shakespeare didn't really write Shakespeare's plays. They were written by another playwright, also named Will Shakespeare. So you have problems with an argument of that nature. Anyway, Domingo's findings would be, A, of considerable scholarly significance. Oh, I should go back and say that. But if he finds that the face of Khafre is, or the face of the Sphinx is not the face of Khafre, well, that's a very powerful piece of evidence for us, because the circumstantial evidence attributing the Sphinx to Khafre is just that, circumstantial, and this supposed similarity seen only by Mark Lehner is a big chunk of that circumstantial evidence. So if we can disqualify that, that's important for us. But if we can't disqualify it, we not exactly fudge around it, but we have a serious complication that we would have to address. So one thing leads to another, and what we now get invited to, when we're doing film as we're going along, Frank is inviting us to his office in the actual police department, and there he has a little office full of, absolutely chock full of information and posters and stuff like that, a lot of them being displays of criminals that have been caught through his forensic work of reconstructing a face according to the memory of whoever it was, the crime victim who remembers seeing such and such a person, and they draw it all out, and this is the nose right or the ears right, and this person is trying to remember, and eventually he ends up with a profile of the alleged criminal, and eventually they catch him. They caught a lot of them. So, of course, Frank was very proud of that. It's a very responsible position as senior forensic detective. So this is going on over several months. We have to put the money together to get over to Egypt on a special trip just to do the forensic work with Frank. And we're taking with us our good friend, the stills photographer, Caroline Davies, a very excellent photographer. In fact, if you go to my website and pull up gallery, you'll find some of her wonderful photographs that she took mostly when we were doing all of this work in Egypt. And they've been converted into, she's turned some of the best of them into greeting cards. So you find those on the website as well, and you can buy her great Egypt greeting cards. Anyway, so Caroline's going with us, and Frank is going with us, and we've got the money together, and off we go to Egypt. We don't need special permissions for this, which is good, because by this time, we have run seriously afoul of the dreaded Zahi Hawass, now a good personal friend, so I'll put that in right here from the get-go, to not to sort of create a false impression about what was then and what's now. But we are not friends at this point in time, and there is no point trying to get special permissions to do our forensic work, but we in fact don't need it. We can operate from as much of a distance, from enough of a distance, we can function. And in fact, when we need special permission in the actual Cairo Museum, we can get this from the museum itself, and we don't have to go through Zahi, who at that time is head of the Giza Plateau. So we're there, and this is very, very meticulous work. When we, for example, to get a full face of the Sphinx, we can't just stand underneath it or from a distance and shoot upward. That's not going to give us the right angle. It has to be done from on a very long distance with a very long photo lens, and with a ladder on top of a truck, because it has to be absolutely on a straight level, and the same applies to the profiles. This is extremely meticulous work that's going on over a number of days. In the museum, it's a real nightmare, because the place is thronged with people, and here we are on ladders and trying to get the right angles for Frank, and people are going back and forth and all around the place. Anyway, eventually he gets all of the material that he needs, and he goes home to study all of this. And I mean, it is quite clear he's not, it's pretty obvious as we're going along that he knows perfectly well that the face of Khafra is not the face of the Sphinx. I mean, it isn't even close, but you can't make a big deal out of this until you actually have the documentation all worked out. And so in due course, but it's quite a lengthy due course, it takes him a while before he can do this. Finally, it's all done and very meticulously worked out, diagrams, photographs, projected things of drawings, illustrations of what the Sphinx might have looked like had its nose not been shut off there, chopped off. There are certain actual real problems involved with the Sphinx, very similar to what an actual police detective, a forensic detective, has to go through in real life, where they're, let's say, doing a reconstruction of a semi-decomposed body or something of that sort. In the case of the Sphinx, the head is in reasonably good shape, but the nose has been completely knocked off, and the serious damage to an eye, the cheekbones, the weathering, it hasn't been much weathered, but there's been pretty considerable damage done to the face, and particularly the nose, which, as Frank says, as Frank points out, that the same face could have 12 different noses. None of those noses might be exactly what we see in the statue of Khafra, but each of those noses would give that face a very, very different look. Now, the reason that the nose is shot off, and this is a little bit of Egyptology that may be of interest to our audience, because there are a number of stories about the ruined face of the Sphinx and who's responsible for it, in currency. One of them is that Napoleon's soldiers back in 1804 shot the nose off the Sphinx, but actually they didn't. There's no evidence for that, and there's plenty of evidence that it happened well before that. And apart from that, Napoleon was going over there with a bunch of scholars as well as soldiers, because he was a mason himself, and he was very interested in proving or trying trying to prove that the roots of the Masonic tradition lay in Egypt. So he wasn't about to shoot the face off the Sphinx. Then there's another rumor that this was done by the Janissaries of the Ottoman Turks. Anyway, that that this was done as it was artillery practice for the Janissaries of the Ottoman Beys, but there's no substantiation for that either. There are even rumors that it wasn't shot off. The nose was damaged in World War I by German soldiers, which is completely ludicrous because there's a ton of pictures from the 19th century showing the Sphinx already ruined. But the answer is actually, and it was furnished me by my opponent Mark Lehner, who pointed out, and who is very knowledgeable in certain respects, that according to Arabic texts, travelers to Egypt over the course of, let's say, the fall of the Roman Empire to about the 12th century, recorded or talked about the incredibly wonderful state of preservation of the head of the Sphinx, mind you, because at those times, over that entire period of time, the Sphinx is buried up to the neck in sand, so nobody even knows that it's a Sphinx. But people talk about this colossal head in a perfect state of preservation, and then suddenly, about the 14th century, the travelers' accounts start talking about the face having been disfigured or destroyed, the nose and the eyes, but the nose particularly, and so it's done by some, let's say, proto-Taliban lunatic who's busy disfiguring the supposedly the pagan or infidel image of the Sphinx. And actually, as a side note, you know, if you go to a museum that has a classical antiquity department, and you'll see all of these statues, Roman, Greek, Etruscan, and so on, often they'll have their noses knocked off. And the usual explanation for this, with a straight face actually, is that, oh, well, the statues fell over and the nose broke off. But what? All the statues fell over and nothing else was damaged or hardly anything, but they all had their noses broken off. No, it's not that at all, actually. It's that in ancient times, the statue represents or contains the living essence of who it's meant to represent. So if for whatever reason, enemies of whoever that person was, king or nobleman or general or whatever, wants to, through magically, kill the, let's say, the disembodied soul or the spiritual essence of the person represented by that statue, the way they do it is by hammering off or breaking off the nose, because it's through the nose that we take in breath, and of course, so the nose of the statue takes in its spiritual breath. So this is why, almost certainly, the nose of the Sphinx was knocked off, and by extension, all of these other noses over the course of art history. Long and short of this expedition to this first expedition to Egypt, and its aftermath is that Frank comes back with all of the data he needs. And lo and behold, the face of the Sphinx is not in any way, shape, or form, no possible way that these two faces, the statue in the Cairo Museum and the Sphinx itself, can be modeled on the same human being. Adverts, we get back to the results of Frank Domingo's investigation and the implications that follow from it. Stay tuned.
Phoenix Fire!
And now, since heretics also have to eat, here come the ads. Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour in DVD, and more besides. If you can't take a trip to Egypt and experience it firsthand, well, you can't. Not everyone can, but next best and the closest you can get to experiencing Egypt is our 8-episode documentary series, Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour. This is the brainchild of my partner, Chance Gardner, a graphic designer and 3D animator of genius, and this series is an absolutely unique visual, emotional, and intellectual media experience. There are innumerable documentaries about Egypt, dry as dust, misleading, repetitive exercises in Egyptological establishmentarianism from the National Geographic or Discovery Channel or some other wielder of the academic cookie cutter, pretty pictures, nothing ever that feeds the mind, the heart, to say nothing of the soul. This series fills that gap. We explore Egypt in depth. We followed the ramifications into alchemy, the tarot deck, modern DNA research, sacred geometry, the mysteries of ancient technology. There are interviews with leading-edge scholars, scientists, and thinkers, each contributing to a radical revision of our understanding of the past. For more information, go to www.magicalegypt.com. And more. If you've not read My Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, maybe it's time you did. An in-depth introduction to Shwala de Lubitsch's symbolist interpretation. Our Emmy Award-winning classic documentary, Mystery of the Sphinx, now available in an upgraded DVD version. My guidebook, A Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, an invaluable source of information for armchair and actual travelers to Egypt. I have a few copies of my out-of-print first non-fiction book, The Case for Astrology, left for sale. See my website, www.jawest.net. Click on books.
Phoenix Fire.
Hello, welcome back to Phoenix Fire. And Frank Domingo, who we left, finishing his results, his comparative study of the Great Sphinx of Giza and the Pharaoh Khafra, supposed carver of the Great Sphinx. The results, considering their implications, quite electrifying. According to Domingo, there was no possible way in which these two radically different faces could possibly have been carved by the same sculptor, or more to the point, could be carved based upon the same face as model. In other words, according to Domingo, the computer, Lehner's computer, is wrong, and Frank Domingo's forensic study supersedes it. Absolutely no way, according to standard forensic understanding, standard forensic procedure, that these two statues, these two faces, are based upon the same model. Argument comes up, as it does sometimes, that, oh, well, why not? Because the carver, whoever carved the Sphinx, was not necessarily the same sculptor who carved the statue of Khafra. This is a non-argument, actually. A face is a face. A skilled sculptor will present that face in a recognizable manner. In other words, if you give 20 different sculptors a commission to do a bust of George W. Bush, all 20 of them will come back with a statue or with a bust that shows you an illiterate, inarticulate, vicious dunce. And all of these will be different from each other. And in fact, if certain of the sculptors happen to be Republicans, deep, serious Republicans, they will try to show George W. Bush in a favorable light. They may even put a halo on him, which will only make the thing worse. He will be unmistakably George W. Bush. The same applies if 20 different sculptors, the same 20 sculptors, are given a commission to do a bust of Bill Clinton. All 20 of them will look like Bill Clinton. Nothing in the world will make Bill Clinton look like George W. Bush. and all 20 of those sculptors will produce a portrait of the man who actually did say, yes, but I didn't inhale. That will be a part of it. That will come with the territory. A Bill Clinton statue is a Bill Clinton statue, and a George W. Bush statue is a George W. Bush statue. The Sphinx, whoever he may have been, is the Sphinx. Actually, might even have been she, maybe. And the Khafre statue is indubitably the Pharaoh Khafre, and they are not the same person. End of argument. Now, this was, in fact, as I said earlier, important from our point of view, because had they been the same person, we could have still kept our argument, because even when I first, I think, in Serpent in the Sky, when I developed this whole theory back in the middle 70s, I even took that into consideration, that the head of the Sphinx could have been recarved by the Pharaoh Khafre, because even at that time, I noted that the face of the Sphinx, or rather the head of the Sphinx, seems curiously out of proportion to its body. And whoever carved the face of the Sphinx, or the head of the Sphinx, was a genius sculptor, and all other Egyptian sphinxes are perfectly proportioned. You look at a Sphinx, and the human head is in the correct proportion. I mean, had it been a lion's head, it would be, you know, a big shaggy mane, but it's basically proportioned correctly. And you look at the Sphinx, especially from a side angle, side and up, so that you get the full perspective, you see that the head is much, much too small for the body. So Domingo absolutely agreed with this as well. And so we're left with a real conundrum, actually, because if the head of the Sphinx is not the original head, and it's carved to represent whoever the model may have been, when did this happen, and who is this model if he is not Khafre? And this may never be resolved unless there's some way of figuring out when the head was actually recarved. But from our point of view, the mere fact that, according to the senior forensic detective of the NYPD, there is no possible way that it could have been based upon the same model as the two statues. For us, this was an important piece of evidence because it destroyed the big chunk of the circumstantial case for Khafre. This, in turn, leads to another little interesting sidelight. We have to fast forward a few years from this point on. I forget exactly how many years, maybe a year or two. But this message went out, or the evidence went out to all and sundry and got a certain amount of press. And at a certain point, I was able to write an op-ed piece for the New York Times op-ed section on Domingo's work. Now, one of the things I did not broach in that op-ed piece... Oh, anyway, I backtrack still again. In the 19th century, many, many, both Egyptologists and mostly travelers to Egypt, noted that the Sphinx looked to them like... that it was a black African face, that it was not an Egyptian African face. I mean, Egypt is, of course, Africa, but the Egyptians are a melting pot even to this day. They're very dark to the south and much lighter to the north, but they're a real melting pot. But nevertheless, they look a lot like most of the ancient Egyptians look in the statues, even from the Old Kingdom. Many of the travelers had noted that the Sphinx, especially in profile, looks as though it's sub-Saharan African. So we asked Domingo about this, and he was very cautious, and he said, well, you know, you can never make a determination like that on the basis of forensics. You have likelihoods and plausibilities. And he said, yes, from his studies, and difficult to do without the nose, but from his very careful forensic studies, he could say, yes, the Sphinx is consistent with sub-Saharan African physiognomy. Well, very, very interesting. Now, when this came back, this news came back to us from Domingo, or this conclusion came back from Domingo, Boris, who was a very crude but very funny guy, said, wow, he said, for the academic Egyptologist, this is bad news and worse news. He said, the bad news is that there wasn't Atlantis, and the worst news is that they were black. We all like that line. But the fact of the matter is that the Sphinx sure does look like sub-Saharan African. Now, the Egyptologists do not want to hear this. They're as prejudiced as everybody else over there. And the last thing in the world that they would want out there is this idea that, A, that it's not Khafre, but not only is it not the same face, it isn't even the same race. So, political reasons, I said nothing about this. And actually, as I said, it's not my original observation anyway. Everybody was saying this, or a lot of people were saying this in the 19th century. I think Gustave Flaubert made that comment as well. So when I wrote my op-ed piece, I said nothing about this. But interestingly enough, a couple of weeks after it appeared, 3 weeks or so, the Times published a letter by an orthodontist who was another expert on faces, like a forensic detective, who made the observation that the face of the Sphinx looks like a sub-Saharan African face, especially in profile. And as far as I'm concerned, I will take the argument no further. It's not my argument. I'm not qualified to comment. But there it is. And I remember if I have or not written about this much in articles and so on. But it's basically that we're in enough hot water as it is. So there's no point stirring up that particular can of worms any more than it has to be. However, there it is. Whoever that Sphinx is meant to represent looks like a sub-Saharan African. Now, maybe that's, in other words, if my own dating of the Sphinx, my personal extreme age, way back dating, I think we talked about that in one of these programs, going back, following the Egyptian text as much as 36,000 years, that one of the intermediate stages, that's who peopled the land of Egypt, when Egypt was under the control or under the rule of the gods themselves or under the rule of the followers or companions of Horus. Who knows? Anyway, at that point, Frank Domingo had done his work, and we were extremely gratified to have those conclusions. And if the academics, if the Egyptologists and the archaeologists want to argue with it, let them, because we'll take Frank's drawings to Lehner's computer any day in the week. And actually, it wouldn't surprise me if these days it would be much easier to, in fact, put the computer to the same task that Lehner could only do with sort of relatively primitive methodology and see what came out again. In other words, it might be worth it for somebody with technical tools to recreate that procedure that Lehner went through and see what you got this time. Wouldn't be me, because I don't know enough about how that's done. But it's something that could be done and might be interesting to see if it comes up the same way again. Now, as you see, this whole story, our Son of Mystery of the Sphinx Part 3, gets complicated as well, and we're trying to follow a number of paths simultaneously. So now we have to reverse. We had this huge press hoo-ha following the GSA meeting in San Diego in 91, and what that did was that generated a debate at the AAAS, that's the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which might be maybe the most prestigious scientific meeting ground in the world, or at least certainly in America. It's the Super Bowl of mainstream science, you might say. So they asked us, we didn't go to them, following all of this tremendous amount of publicity and controversy and argument and fight and so on, they asked us to do, if we would agree to, an actual debate at the meeting coming up in Chicago in February of 93. Now, this is one of the most prestigious scientific venues in the world. I am not sure if in order to participate in this thing, you are obliged to have scientific credentials after your name. I'm not sure of that. But anyway, I don't have them. And even though it was my theory and Schwaller's idea, my theory, me doing all of the work to bring it up to where it was, shock, of course, corroborating it. Without that, we would be absolutely nowhere. And Tom DeBecky's geophysical studies implemented our work in a very powerful way, quite technical, but very powerful. So I wasn't allowed to be part of this debate. And so it was Schock and Tom DeBecky versus Mark Lehner and K. Lal Gowrie, who was a geologist who had spent a lot of time with Lehner in the middle 80s doing very exhaustive studies on the Sphinx, not questioning the weathering and not questioning the chronology, but having to do with the deterioration of the Sphinx and what to do to slow this down or turn the clock back. Gowrie actually is not an expert in weathering or the various fields that are associated with the weathering of the Sphinx, but rather he's an expert in stone conservation, So his job was to conserve the Sphinx and not agitate the waters by throwing a monkey wrench into the waters. So even though these were extremely detailed studies and very valuable from other points of view, the question of the weathering to the Sphinx and the need to rethink its age was never actually addressed. And now in this case, this is not an oversight, particularly on the part of Lehner, because here we get into another interesting sort of side journey or branch of this complex tapestry. Yeah, you can't have a branch of tapestry, but another thread that goes through the tapestry, and that is Mark Lehner himself, who started off as an Edgar Cayce advocate. Cayce, as you all probably know, was a famous American psychic, and he would go into trances and detail whole things about the history of Egypt, and Atlantis was a big part of the whole Cayce channeling. This would be another program in its own right, and in fact, one of these days, maybe I'll do it. Program on the Cayce connection. Long and short of it was that Mark Lehner was brought up in a Cayce household, I guess, and as a long-haired hippie in San Francisco somewhere in the 60s, maybe, late 60s, somewhere around there, was sponsored by or encouraged by the Cayce Foundation to get his degree in archaeology and Egyptology, and with the hope that he would be their point man, Edgar Cayce's point man, into... Cayce also thought the Sphinx and the pyramids were much older than their current attribution. And so Lehner started off with that in mind and, in fact, wrote a very early book, name of which I forget at the moment, that he repudiates completely because at some point or another decided that the Cayce evidence did not really pan out and that Orthodox Egyptology had the right answers. Unfortunately, Lehner should have known better than this because I guess the first time I met him was 1980 or thereabouts, shortly after My Serpent in the Sky was published, and he was presented with and read and was familiar with the whole argument from a weathering point of view. Oddly enough, the Cayce people themselves were not interested in the weathering point of view then. They are now, but now it's too late. And they had their man... Mark Lehner in place, and they didn't want to know about weathering. And so all of a sudden, they didn't have Mark Lehner in place. He became an opponent rather than a proponent, and they weren't. Actually, they were one of the contributors to our Mystery of the Sphinx, to when Boris was putting the money together to get us all over there to do the work. Anyhow, so Lehner actually had, he knew that the theory was out there. Whether or not Gowrie knew, I'm not sure. But there we were at the invited February. I'm in the audience, but Schock and Dobecki are up there, and Lehner and Gowrie are on the other side. And this was an extremely polite on the surface, but the aftermath or the confrontations out in the hall once the hour of debate was over were remarked upon by, again, the press of the world as very icy and at the same time very hot. Thank you very much. Next week, we come back to Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, Part 3. We continue with the AAAS, and we get into the Book of Boris and the Mystery of the Sphinx, the video. Thank you.
Available at www.jawphoenixfire.blogspot.com. Music and production by Geraint Hughes. www.thepodule.com. More information on John Anthony West is available at www.jawest.net.